my great pleasure to be here. Speaking on a subject that I began researching during my year 35 years ago at Yale University. At that time, I told my professors, because they granted me huge amounts of independent study, that I wanted to pursue this topic as I felt it would be the cutting edge in the future. And they told me, well, we don't know any genuine research in this field, and that if you find something, let us know. Now I find that 35 years later, this is a hot subject. And I speak about it quite often at universities in Australia and New Zealand. I'm born in New York, but I'm a New Zealand citizen. And surprisingly, in the former Soviet Union, where they're having to face problems of a few people prospering fantastically, whereas the general population, many of them think that although the oppression, the political oppression and harsh economic realities during the Soviet days were way over the top, nevertheless, there was some kind of security that they don't have now. So, believe it or not, the Russians are very concerned. Could there be some other economic alternative? Now, as I said, I used to think 35 years ago that not much work was being done in this field. But as you can see on the screen there, things are, let's get that back here, yes. Things are quite different these days. And there's so much research that we can take advantage of. Just briefly, I'll let you glance at that. Tonight we're going to be speaking about a lot of things that are new and a lot of things that are very old. Because this is a different kind of subject matter today, I hope you won't mind that I introduce some mantra meditation as an indicator of possibilities for a spiritual economy, because we're going to be briefly discussing how a spiritual economy is not based on getting, but giving. And for such a radical transformation of human motives, there needs to be some kind of transcendent methodology. So we simply would like you to sample for a few minutes this mantra meditation, because I've been traveling on every continent of the world for over a quarter of a century, and I've seen that unless people have some kind of higher level to tap into, they're naturally going to simply be trapped on the level of lower motivation. Once again, self-interest at operation, but in the spiritual sphere. As Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, India's main spiritual text, when you get the higher taste, you automatically let go of the lower taste. So we see that self-interest can play an extraordinary role, not only in markets, but also in spiritual development. I'm going to ask two of my assistants, Keshava, he's working in marketing, and Vrindavan, she's finishing her master's degree here at the University of Toronto in microbiology. So they think very deeply about these subjects, and I'm just going to ask them for a few minutes only to demonstrate some mantra meditation before we plunge into the nitty-gritty of today's reality and what could be based on very ancient knowledge from India about economic development. So please take this as an interesting and perhaps quite profound demonstration. And then we'll get on with our subject matter.
So, I believe that the mantra will be put up on the screen, so please feel free to call and respond. Type of meditation to try it out. We highly recommend it because it also helps to bring about a very nice sense of peacefulness. So we'll start.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
what's new. In the past 10 years, there's been an enormous outburst of research on prosperity, happiness, and choice. The context is, in the current situation of economics, are people actually becoming happy? I'm going to give you a brief overview of the latest research during the past 5 or 7 years. The contention is, can it be true that as a society grows wealthier and people become freer to do whatever they want, they get less happy? Indeed, the research points in this direction, and this has quite some economic significance, because naturally, human beings, when they engage in economic affairs, seek to satisfy needs and wants. But suppose inherent in the current economic process, the satisfaction of the needs and wants is not possible. Let me give you a brief overview of that kind of research. First, we'll turn to David Myers of Hope College, combined with Robert Lane of Yale University. Their studies reveal that increased choice and increased affluence have become accompanied by decreased well-being, as measured in the USA and most other affluent societies. Some statistical background which may shed some light on the matter. In the USA, the GDP has more than doubled in the past 30 years. But the proportion of the population describing itself as very happy has declined by 5%. 5% means 14 million people. In Japan, in approximately the past 40 years, the GDP has quintupled, yet the number of people describing themselves as basically happy has remained the same or has dipped slightly. This kind of research is spurring scholars to question the fundamentals, the basics of human economic activity. Naturally, it's felt that people want to satisfy their necessities as well as their needs. But now we're finding out that in the most affluent, privileged, economically, that is, societies, there is a decrease in measured happiness. We're going to look more at that significant happening. We'll turn to research by Barry Schwartz, who also relies quite a bit on the late Nobel Prize-winning psychologist and economist, what a combination, Herbert Simon of Carnegie Mellon University. Herbert Simon comes with a term known as satisficers, those persons in an economy who are satisfied that my choice is good enough. I've considered all the options I want to consider. I've made what I consider to be a reasonably good choice. Leave it at that. Then you have Barry Schwartz's term, maximizers. Those are persons who constantly are evaluating, sifting, studying, reviewing, in the hopes of making the best possible choice. This is quite an arduous process, but they are possessed by the desire to make the best of all possible choices at every moment. Now, research has shown that the maximizers are the most miserable. And those satisficers, as Herbert Simon called them, they're okay. It's not that they are lazy, like, I don't want to think about what's the best product, I just choose what's in front of me. No, they make a measured attempt to sift through the options, and then once they decide, they leave it at that. They don't become haunted with what I could have chosen, as the maximizers do. So, what is the lifestyle of the maximizer? Because we find that this is the category that somehow or other society is pushing people into. They engage in more product comparisons, both before and after making the purchase. They take longer to decide what they want to buy. However, the satisficer, when they find an item that meets their standards, they stop looking. But the maximizers exert tremendous effort, reading labels, checking out consumer magazines, researching on the internet, trying new products. And they also are constantly looking at what other people have and weighing the various options. The more information that's available, the more the choice, the decision becomes agonizing. And then, after they finally make a selection, research has shown, they are nagged by alternatives they had no time to investigate. Oh no, I didn't know about that review. I didn't know about that alternative. So in the end, it is a fact. The maximizers are more likely to make a better choice, as measured by objective standards in terms of cost, quality, and so on. But although they make the better objective choice, they get less satisfaction from the choice. Less satisfaction than the satisficers. So this kind of data is pushing researchers to question what's going on with the economic human being. You find that the greatest maximizers are the least happy. Indeed, by psychological standards, they often border on clinical depression because their determination to make the best choice in all circumstances so consumes them that they have no peace. As many of you know, depression is considered by the World Health Organization to be in a few years, it'll be the number two disease in the world behind heart problems. This kind of information doesn't bode well for economic incentive and activity as currently known. That will be a theme of this discussion, especially as we turn into the ancient economic knowledge of India. Now, some more of that latest research. Besides maximizers experiencing great regret after a purchase, if their acquisition disappoints them, they also tend to brood, and they take a much longer time to recover from their brooding because they're so hard on themselves. Why did I get that? I should have done that. Why did I go to Paris? I should have gone to Miami. Let's turn to the research by Columbia University psychologists Rachel Elmer and Sheena Iyengar. They found that the maximizer college seniors graduating from Columbia, in their search for jobs, their thorough, agonizing search as a maximizer, they indeed found positions with 20% higher starting salaries than the satisficer type job seekers. So, objectively, they scored higher. Their jobs were better in terms of monetary reward. Yet, they were less satisfied with the jobs they got, and they were exhausted by the whole job searching process. So this is very ominous. It means, from all measurable data, that maximizers are less happy than satisfied. Now, let's analyze various subdivisions of this overall discontent that maximizers are feeling. A society, remember, has pushed them to make the best choice at every moment. That's the symbol of your success as a human being. Yet, the happiness and satisfaction is not followed. First of all, there's something called opportunity cost. The quality of any given choice cannot be assessed in isolation from its alternative. That means if you decided to go on a vacation to Paris, you turned up various possibilities. You could have gone to Acapulco. You could have gone to London. So that opportunity cost has to be factored in. And the more alternatives there are, the deeper the sense of loss will be, and the less satisfaction you'll derive from your ultimate decision. I find this welding of economics and psychology to be very powerful, especially today. Such information was not available during my years at Yale University. Now, let's once again look at the stereotype of the maximizer. It may be someone that we know. The maximizer imagines all possibilities for making a choice, even possibilities that aren't present at the moment. No matter how satisfied the maximizer is with his job, her job, it's only right, he or she feels, to be on the lookout for better opportunities. When he maximizes in the car, listening to the radio, he or she often checks out other stations because maybe something better is playing. Even though he or she is relatively satisfied with what they are hearing. Currently, when they watch TV, they channel surf, scanning through other channels, even while attempting to watch one program. In terms of relationships, maximizers treat them like clothing. Try a lot on before finding the perfect fit. When it comes to shopping for a friend, oh, it's with great agony. Renting, even a simple thing as renting a video or DVD, is very difficult because so many choices. And maximizers are extraordinary fans of lists. Amazon.com takes advantage of that. The best this, the best that, the best movies, the best books, the best singers, the best actors, on and on and on it goes. Maximizers love this. They find that no matter what they do, they have to have the highest standard. They never settle for second best. And they're proud of it, in spite of their own discontent accrued by this process. And they often fantasize about living in ways that are quite different from their actual life. Now, we talked about opportunity costs. This is especially borne out in the research of Nobelist psychologist Daniel Kahneman of Princeton University and his late colleague Amos Tversky of Stanford. When you look at the opportunity cost, losses have a much greater psychological impact than gains. Losses make us hurt more than gains make us feel good. So therefore, for the maximizer to make a choice in which loss is incurred weighs so heavily upon the heart and eats away at the innards, so to speak. Be satisfied for however things, good enough. I see some possibilities, I've made my choice, good enough, let's live and let live on with another day. They're happier in all respects. Of course, generally speaking, the current economic situation of affluent societies does not encourage satisficeness. You want people to constantly get something better, newer versions, customized versions, personalized versions. Then you have to deal with regret. There's opportunity cost, and then there is regret sensitivity. People feel when they make a choice, afterwards, oh, what about the other choices? If I only went to Acapulco instead of Paris. But there is also regret sensitivity. When their choice does not turn out to be anywhere near what they expected, and indeed they feel they made a mistake. It's not that simply maybe Acapulco would have been better, but Paris turned out to be a disaster. They torture themselves with regret. Now, psychologists have theorized that worry over future regret is a major reason that individuals become maximizers. Because the only way you can be sure not to regret a decision is by making the best possible decision. From opportunity cost and regret sensitivity, we're going to go to adaptation. Adaptation dulls joy. This concept comes from very recent research by Daniel Gilbert of Harvard and Timothy Wilson of the University of Virginia. They've come out with some very interesting understandings. Nothing unusual if you look at the spiritual texts of ancient India. But what I like about this research is it's bringing out those same points in a way that contemporary persons will accept those points. You're seeing the hard data. You're seeing the actual research behind making such powerful statements. Adaptation means that you get what you want, if you're lucky, if you're fortunate, yet what you finally get diminishes in returns. You don't get the same fresh buzz, so to speak, after a while. For example, let's say you decided to buy a Mercedes. Now, you buy it, and once you settle on the Mercedes, you put all other attractive car models out of your mind, and you make your choice. But that putting the others out of the mind is just temporary, because what happens? At first, Daniel Gilbert says you feel joy, the first instinct, my acquisition, my possession. But certainly, the freshness declines. Experience starts to fall just a bit flat. And then, gradually, as time moves on, you're hit with a double punch. Regret about what you didn't choose and disappointment with what you have. It's natural human psychology, in other words, to think, maybe I should have got the BMW after all. Look around me. Those driving BMWs seem to be a bit more sporty. People are looking at me as a bit staid and conservative in my Mercedes. This is not anything, how do we say, eccentric. In other words, these researchers are finding out this is basic human psychology which manifests in economic affairs. So, adaptation means no matter what you get, once you finally get it, you're not going to remain satisfied long with it. Finally, along with opportunity cost, regret, and adaptation, there is the curse of high expectations. This was borne out in a survey done by the New York Times and CBS News. They asked teenagers to compare their experiences with those their parents had growing up. Now, 50% of the children from affluent households said their lives were harder. Why would they say such a thing? They're born with a silver spoon in their mouth, so to speak. They're receiving the benefit of their parents either climb up the economic ladder or if the parents were children of wealthy parents, they're experiencing the benefit of being born to parents who held their own. So why do such children, 50% of them born in affluent households, say their lives were harder? Upon being questioned further, these adolescents all talked about high expectations. Both the expectations they had of themselves and the expectations of their parents. They explained everything is too much. There are too many activities we have to do, too many consumer choices, too much to learn. So they're feeling the pressure that if we fall back to an economic level beneath our parents, that would be the greatest nightmare. In other words, if your perch is high, you have much further to fall than if your perch is low. So these psychological afflictions are weighing in very heavily, to the extent that they are now forming large-scale social trends. I give you this information and this research as incentive that probably we should be looking at other possibilities, how to organize human beings in terms of their economic affairs, satisfying their needs and their wants. Because what's happening is that the maximizers, which are held to be the elite group, they are fine candidates for depression. We can turn to the research a quarter of a century ago of the late Clyde Coombs of the University of Michigan. He noted that good feelings satiate and bad feelings escalate. The good feelings quickly peter out in terms of the bang they're going to give you, whereas the bad feelings just increase and increase as you become more and more gloomy. This is human psychology, and we feel that this psychological information has great impact on the economic affairs of human beings. Somehow or other, Barry Schwartz, who specializes in research about choice, has concluded that our production and consumption ideas may very well rest on assumptions that are deeply mistaken. That it's not that if people get newer and newer versions, personalized versions, customized versions, on ad infinitum, it's not that they're going to be happier. Indeed, they're becoming more distressed. So, now we're going to go midway between this new research and turning to the ancient economic knowledge of India in the Vedic literature. Many thinkers are saying that today we've reached a point in history where we must rethink the very nature and meaning of human progress. Mass marketing and the notion of unlimited consumption, rather than being our economic deliverance in a spiral of ever-increasing prosperity, they're turning out to be something else. Therefore, many intelligent people are wondering, can we continue living in nature, impacting nature as we do? Everyone knows about that topic. And now we have these psychological information about the effects of affluence and choice. It is now legitimate to ask these questions. Many are saying we're at a stage in human history when the notion of unlimited growth can no longer go unquestioned. We need a new vision of society, a new vision of economics that's not based on ever-increasing number of goods. An ever-increasing number of goods. There has to be some other vision. Everyone knows the growth ethic is about consumption. The greater number of things a society produces and the number of things individuals have supposedly creates greater happiness. Now, we can analyze the present situation, we can criticize it, but when it comes to constructing a new vision, what are we going to do? This is becoming the question of the day. All right, what we have now obviously has its defects. Human beings can't go on living in a world of increasing scarcity and detrimental impact on nature, on. But what is better? Is there another vision? In other words, we can't just show people that they're being fooled as these economic psychologists, I recall, have done with very powerful research showing that your choices are not going to make you happy, and indeed, the more choice you have, the more chance you have to be miserable. You have to move beyond that. We need an alternative vision, and an alternative vision is based on an alternative way of understanding who we are. That is why I'll bring you in a few minutes to the ancient economic knowledge of India. Everyone knows we engage in economic activities to satisfy our needs and wants. Obviously, then, we have to understand who are human beings, what are their actual needs, what are their actual wants. According to hardline Western materialistic economic perspective, I say hardline, human beings are nothing more than producing, consuming machines whose best interests are realized when production and consumption are performed at peak efficiency. When I turn to the ancient Vedic knowledge, I'm going to point out a different perspective of the human being. The Vedic perspective holds that human beings are complex, multidimensional beings, and therefore you can't analyze their wants and needs simply in terms of one very limited dimension, the matter dimension. In other words, if we are simply the body, just matter, then there might be some validity to materialistic economics. But if indeed we are something more than matter, then we'll find that we're heading in the wrong direction. So once I turn to the ancient spiritual knowledge of India, particularly in regards to economics, yet out of necessity I'm going to have to deal with a different conception of what is the human being. If we are just matter, then matter and our quest for it should be the be-all and end-all of life. But if we have other dimensions to ourselves, then things have to go in a different direction. Now, why would we dare to think there could be some other dimension to human nature other than matter? When speaking at the premier scientific schools in India, generally there's not too much attention these days being put on the humanities in India. Everything is for technology. So when I'm speaking at the scientific institutions, naturally they want to know, how can you with credibility bring in a non-material understanding of the human being? So I point to consciousness. The fact that there is no material scientific explanation of consciousness, that should let you know that there is something non-material about our core being. There's not one scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. The only reason that I know you're conscious is because I'm conscious. So based on that first-hand evidence, I think that you're also conscious because you're acting like me. Other than that, there is no direct scientific evidence of my being conscious, your being conscious, or what is consciousness. Now, you could say roughly 33% of scientists commenting on consciousness say, we don't know what it is, and we'll probably never know. Another 33% say, we don't know what it is, but we hope to know it in the future. And then a last third say, consciousness is matter. It's a material phenomena. Material phenomena, there's no doubt about it. Even though we can't prove it, we're sure. But this is the state of the art, so to speak, about what probably is the most important field of human inquiry. Because without understanding our consciousness, how can we say we truly understand economics or science or whatever? Because everything comes to us through the medium of our consciousness. Now, sometimes people say, oh, here you go again with the ghost in the machine. You're talking about some non-material entity that's inhabiting the body of matter. I'll turn it around and say, let's not talk about the machine in the ghost. In other words, and with the mechanism of the unknown consciousness, you're trying to establish the known. Through the unknown, you're trying to perceive the known. Therefore, machine in the ghost. better to try and understand what exactly is the makeup of the human being. And then, indeed, if we construct our economics on that platform, we may be able to have a more sane way of life. Now, how is it that if we are consciousness, being consciousness indicative of a spirituality, how is it that we've forgotten this? The ancient Vedic texts of India point out that by contact with matter in an acquisitive manner, one loses his or her spiritual understanding. False identification with matter, false identification with material nature, produces forgetfulness of one's spiritual identity, one's non-material identity. That's step one. And then step two is that this false identification with matter then results in false ownership of things. First of all, I am this body. And then it's natural. Things in relation to the body are me and mine. And based on that illusion, this is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, based on that illusion, all of life's problems and complexities multiply. Now, the way of living recommended for economic affairs in the ancient spiritual texts of India is to understand all material resources are offered to the living entity for peaceful living in terms of discharging the duty of enlightenment. It's not that the material resources are out there for overaccumulation and exploitation. The resources are provided by nature, by superior control, so that people can get their necessities while focusing the aim of their life on a spiritual development. We'll get more into that later in terms of how that affects economic affairs. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna gives a very interesting analysis, which brilliantly applies to the consumerism so present today. While contemplating the objects of the senses, Krishna says, a person develops attachment for them. This is every marketer's dream. They're contemplating my product, and they're starting to identify with it. They're feeling attachment for it, emotional yearning for it. Indeed, that product becomes them. From such attachment comes a strong desire for contacting that object, that possession. I've got to have it. When will I be able to get it? You want those things so that you can possess them, control them, and enjoy them. And therefore, you'll work hard to acquire them. What's the beginning of this cycle? Contemplation with your consciousness. Yes, that's what I need. That's what I want. That will satisfy me. From that contemplation, the other steps follow. And then finally, you want and you'll get for possessing, controlling, and enjoying. You'll go through ordeals, austerities, just to obtain those items. What's the result? Frustration of these desires, and therefore there's anger. Now normally, we would say, frustration of the desire generates anger. That sounds like some kind of typical religious platitude, some kind of typical spiritual talk. But remember, we've already presented the research in the past 7 years of very prominent academics about how choice is leading to misery, how there's the cost of opportunity, there's adaptation, there's regret sensitivity, there's the pain of high expectations. So, in other words, the traditional economic advice in the ancient Vedic texts, particularly as spoken by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, is looking more and more contemporary. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes that the very act of our enjoying the objects of the senses conditions your spiritual consciousness for identification with the body and its senses. Just by immersing yourself in the act of interacting with material nature, material objects, matter, for the purpose of happiness, conditions you. It's not an innocent activity. It's an activity that reduces your possible awareness of your non-material identity. Now, because modern economic development, and to most extent, is going on with no spiritual background, there's no doubt people have become increasingly lusty, greedy, and mad after money. And they've neglected the development of their higher qualities and what can be the outcome for the entire society. What I'm going to introduce in this discussion is nothing so new, but I'd like that we think about it in the current context, that life's real pleasure is not taking, but giving. This sounds like a simple platitude, but if you take it to its deepest level, I'm sure you'll see opportunity for amazing transformation on an individual level and on the social level. The life's real pleasure is giving and not taking. The problem is, our present economic structure has made the natural pleasure of giving so difficult to perform. Why would I say something like that? The emphasis is on acquisition, because you need to get to satisfy yourself. You have wants and needs that can't be neglected. The more affluent you are, the more choices you have, the happier you'll be. You've talked about that. Now, to go against that kind of brain takes enormous impetus. Where is that impetus going to come from? We'll deal with that later. That impetus has to come from somewhere. Otherwise, we won't have the energy for what it takes. We won't have the energy necessary for transforming an economy of taking into an economy of giving. We have to develop spiritual values, and in that way, people can make saner choices. In our final part here, we're going to turn to an ancient Vedic text called Srimad Bhagavata, which is considered to be the postgraduate study of spiritual science. There we have an enclave described happening thousands of years ago, just like we're having an enclave here. At this enclave were the greatest sages of ancient India. They had gathered with the determination that they weren't going to leave their enclave until they could understand what is the absolute and ultimate good for all people. With their, shall we say, psychic vision, they could look ahead and see. In the coming years, in the coming millenniums, they're going to become more and more unfortunate in terms of the ability to concentrate on spiritual knowledge. Their minds are going to become more and more disturbed by short-term goals. And they won't have the clarity or the composure to actually understand what is their ultimate good. Therefore, what to do? What recommendations could they make? They noted there are so many recommendations. There are so many spiritual literatures, so many spiritual saints giving advice. We have to select what is the essence of all good advice for the benefit of all human beings. And what is the point of all that? In Sanskrit, yenatma supersedati. I quote Sanskrit not to show any acquisition of knowledge, but to show that what I'm saying is authorized, just like we, in scholar discussions, we present the research, we present the data. So therefore, in the same spirit, I'm quoting from the ancient spiritual texts of India, particularly in regard to economic affairs. How can the self, meaning the non-material entity, be satisfied? The word atma, in yatma supersedati, it refers on the lowest level to the body. It refers on the medium level to the mind. But at its deepest level, that same word atma refers to the particle of spiritual consciousness known as the soul. How is that going to be satisfied? We want to know that for the benefit of all human beings. So they wait for their answer. They actually submit this question to the senior most spiritual professor in their midst. And what does that senior most spiritual professor, his name is Sutta Goswami, what does he say? He says, oh, sages, oh, fellow spiritual academics, I've been justly questioned by you. Your questions are worthy because they relate to Lord Krishna and are so relevant to the world's welfare. Only questions of this sort are capable of completely satisfying the self. Now remember, that word self is a translation of the Sanskrit word atma, which refers to a multidimensional human being, body, mind, and soul. But it's not that all the dimensions are equal. Just like I'm wearing cloth here, I'm wearing a vest. You might say that these are dimensions of my persona, one way or another, but they are temporary. They're covering. What is it about me that doesn't change when the clothes change, or when the body changes, or when the mind changes? So that is the use by these sages of the word self, or atma. They concluded, let's look at economic affairs first. All occupational engagements are meant for freedom from material existence, for enlightenment. They should never be performed for material gain. This sounds quite shocking. How do you perform your occupation in such a way that it's never for material gain? That is the profound knowledge that the current economic understanding of human beings requires. What these sages are saying is that you work in order to obtain spiritual development through the workplace, through your occupation, how to generate spiritual development for yourself and for others. Therefore, you're in the mood of constantly giving. How, by my work, can I create a lifestyle for myself so that I can deepen my spiritual experience and my spiritual knowledge? We're not speaking about religious belief here. We want to move beyond belief into actual experience, just like advertising is offering experience. Things for your senses, things for your mind. You're going to feel good in this way. You're going to experience that. The spiritual equivalent of advertising is genuine spiritual experience. If such techniques for genuine spiritual experience, far beyond the province of religious belief, are made available in a mass way to people, then obviously they can transform their lifestyles and participate in an economy of giving and not taking. When they look at their work as a chance to spiritually develop, now how does that happen? This is especially explained by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that you work for the simple maintenance of your body, but the goal of your work is how to increase the general stock of spiritual enlightenment for yourself and society. In other words, for those of you who may be yoga practitioners, please note that yoga does not simply refer to exercises for the body. It also refers to connecting your work, your economic activities, to the source of all energies. That's why the understanding of Krishna is so important. Krishna refers to the source of all energies. If we can connect our occupation in an actual experiential way to the source of all energy, and we can distribute that experience, then there's no question of scarcity, there's no question of adaptation, opportunity cost, regret. Instead of seeing our economic affairs, our engagement in economic affairs as a chance for me to get, for me, instead we're thinking, by engaging in these economic affairs, I can give more. I can give more to my family. I can give more to society in terms of non-material goals. Goals that actually can satisfy, instead of what we heard about in the beginning, about the hidden psychological costs of affluence, choice, acquisition, and so forth. So this is what these sages at this enclave are talking about. They met at a place you'll still find in India. It's called Naimisharanya. And they valid. We're not going to leave as enclave until we hammer out a conclusion. How people who will be living in a coming troubled time, when they're not a time troubled because of lack of technological innovation, but a time that's troubled because of lack of peace of mind, high stress, high anxiety, no satisfaction, and no care. What is the self? What is the true nature of the human identity beyond temporary body and mind? How can people, all the people, be benefited in such circumstances? So, we want to present this giving economy as an actual solution, but it won't work just based on moral platitude. And this is the Krishna conscious contribution. That simple moral platitude, you gotta give, not get. You gotta enliven others, not just take for yourself. If you just exhort people in that way, it's not going to work. You have to indeed tune into the psychology of marketers. At what are you giving that will so satisfy the senses, that will attract the senses and satisfy them? Spiritual experience has to be like that. Therefore, if we turn to spiritual traditions that directly address this experience, rather than religious belief, we might find interesting information that could benefit all of human society. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, unless you get the higher taste, taste is not anything theoretical, it's not anything beliefy, it is actual sensory experience. Unless the human being experiences the higher taste, the human being is not going to be able to give up the lower taste. He or she is not going to be able to extract himself or herself from the production-consumption cycle in terms of life going on in a destructive way. You can talk about it till you're blue in the face, but unless people get a taste of something else, they're not going to be able to extricate themselves. But this is what I feel is the most profound implication of the ancient spiritual economic information from India, that there's something else that we have to nourish. And the fact that there's something else, I say fact, is because no one can understand materially what is consciousness. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that consciousness is the energy of the Atma, or the non-material unit. If we can understand that we may need non-material means of satisfaction, we can look at economic activity with a different vision. Once people understand that I can give, my work, my economic development, my business is meant for enhancing spiritual enlightenment for everyone, then you can see a transformation. Of course, your next question will be, how do you know what genuine spiritual enlightenment is? And, everyone's got their religious belief. Well, I can turn it around and say, that's the same as my saying, well, all the cars are the same, and there's so many different kinds of cars to buy, so many different types of suits and dresses. What? No. We can apply the maximizer consciousness spiritually, and will benefit so much. Let me analyze the options. Let me look into them very deeply. Let me talk. Let me see the reviews. Let me find out where is the most profound and comprehensive spiritual knowledge. So in other words, when that maximizer consciousness is applied to consumption, there's trouble bordering on cynical depression. Take that same attitude and apply it to the quest for genuine spiritual knowledge, comprehensive spiritual knowledge, and the maximizer is doing great. But in this way, we advocate a complete transformation of the economy based on giving, not getting, the joys of giving. But this will only be a platitude. I guarantee it will only be wishful thinking unless people can actually taste a higher spirituality. And that taste causes their self-interest to act in a spiritual way. But as long as the predominant culture the predominant economic culture, is pushing it for you. The more affluence you have, the more choices you'll have, the more happy you'll be. It's very difficult for people to think clearly about these subjects and make an intelligent decision. So I ask you to consider these topics very deeply, certainly with your illustrious backgrounds, you can no doubt go into them much deeper. The time is now to consider these things. So many people are saying, so many academics are saying, as you know better than me, things can't go on the way they are. But what is better? What's the choice? Do we make a little modification here, a little tinkering there? Doesn't seem to be enough. Indeed, just as the ancient sages of India, the ancient Krishna conscious practitioners of India, discovered thousands of years ago, we have to deal with the root issues if we're going to have beneficial economic affairs. What is the Atma? What is the self? Are we just matter engaged in production, consumption? Or perhaps we have a material covering and there is a particle of indestructible consciousness indicative of an indestructible entity. Then the economic yoga of the ancient Vedic text takes you further. Not only is there the unit of consciousness known as the Atma or soul, loosely speaking, there's also a supreme Atma or supreme unit of consciousness which includes all the other small part and parcel units of consciousness. And the connection between the Atma and what is called in Sanskrit the Paramatma, the supreme Atma, that connection is where the pleasure is. And real yoga means how to maximize activities in the relation between the Atma and the Paramatma, between the living entity, particle consciousness, and the supreme consciousness. This is what Krishna consciousness is about. Once someone is trained by proper techniques to mine that relationship between the minute soul and the supreme soul, they get a pleasure that cannot be compared in any way to the quote-unquote joys of material acquisition. In other words, if you can train people to tap into something that's inexhaustible, something that is not hampered by time and space, you can much easily satisfy people. Now, I spent 8 years underground in the former communist Eastern Europe speaking about these things. We all know, Marx said, religion is the opium of the people. If, however, you actually have genuine spiritual experience, not just religious belief, that you could say tranquilizes people. If just as they're experiencing what the advertisers and the marketers want them to experience, contemplating the product, desiring the product, contacting the product, if they can have genuine spiritual experience, they'll be protected against their lower instincts. And then, indeed, you can build a sane world. But the problem is, as long as we think the body is the self, the mind is the self, we're not going to go any further than gross physical attempts for satisfaction and mental attempts for satisfaction. So, I've just tried to give you a brief overview of this very exciting path for research, and I hope that it proves to have some value for you. Thank you very much.